Hi, it's Charlie Connolly here. I write every week in the New European on books and literature and great European lives. If you'd like to enjoy more from the New European, you can join us by subscribing at theneweuropean.co.uk/subscribe. That's theneweuropean.co.uk/subscribe. Great European Lives from the New European. Josephine de Beauharnais, 23rd of June 1763 to the 29th of May 1814. They ate in silence. It had been a long, overwhelming day, and both were too exhausted for conversation. The distance between the Tuileries Palace, where they dined together on the evening of December the 2nd, 1804, and Notre Dame Cathedral, was little more than a mile. Looking across the table to where the newly crowned French Emperor was picking wearily at his food, Josephine felt as if the coronation had taken place in a different world altogether. Her ears still rang from the acclaim of the crowds, not to mention the 400 choristers and 300 musicians who'd performed at the ceremony. They were acclaiming him, of course, the Emperor Napoleon, but also her, Josephine, his consort, the Empress of the French. Vivat Imperator in aeternum, Pope Pius VII had exclaimed at the conclusion of the investiture. May the Emperor live forever. At that moment, sitting on a throne one level beneath that of her husband, high on the specially constructed triumphal arch, Josephine felt it plausible that her husband could indeed live forever. Looking out across the cathedral, at the rows of dignitaries sitting between the blazing light of the massive crystal chandeliers hung for the occasion, she could almost believe she would live forever herself. Mortality was something Josephine knew all about. Behind Napoleon as they dined, at the far end of the palace grounds, was the Place de la Révolution. It was where, almost exactly a decade earlier, Josephine, wearing a filthy linen smock and with her hair chopped short, had come within a whisker of being guillotined. Just another victim of Robespierre's reign of terror. From a prisoner of the Revolution, lying on a thin, lice-ridden straw mattress in a rat-infested cell, to wearing crimson velvet trimmed with gold, as her husband, the most powerful man in Europe, placed the crown of the Empress on her head. As personal reinventions go, this was pretty spectacular. But then, personal reinvention was Josephine's speciality. Her half-century on this planet encompassed some of Europe's most tumultuous times, most decisive moments, and most important characters. If she wasn't the instigator of key events whose ramifications we still feel today, she was always intimate with them, either as victim, facilitator, or confidant. That's how she hauled herself up from being the Creole daughter of a struggling Caribbean sugar planter to the ultimate darling of Parisian society, taking some of the most powerful men in the land to her bed, the society women who had once sniggered at her rough-edged immigrant accent, hanging on her every word. Most of the time, events were out of her control. Such was the nature of European womanhood in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, but never has powerlessness become so powerful. What limited control she had over her life and her world, she identified quickly and utilized deftly, enabling an extraordinary rise from immigrant outsider to the woman closest to the most absolute power exercised in modern European history. Yet, all the while she was an insider, she remained, at heart, an outsider. One night in October 1795, Marie-Joseph de Beauharnais, then a 33-year-old aristocratic widow, attended a dinner as a favour to her lover, Paul Barras, who in the post-Robespierre governmental chaos of the previous year had been the closest France had to an outright leader. It was the fall of Robespierre at the end of July 1794 that had saved her life. she was due to be guillotined within days, a fate that had already befallen her estranged husband, the Viscount Alexandre de Beauharnais. Like many men, Barras had found her utterly intoxicating, and their relationship was intensely physical, their parties riotously bawdy, as, within a matter of weeks, the widow de Beauharnais moved from rats and gruel to the most opulent dining rooms, palaces, and bedchambers in Paris. At dinner that autumn evening, the young general seated next to Marie-Joseph became instantly as smitten as Barras by her lofty charm and aura of advanced sexual accomplishment. Napoleon Bonaparte, 6 years her junior, did not have quite the same effect on her. She found him rude, scruffy, ill-mannered, and boring. Still, within 6 months, they were married. Napoleon had been infatuated from the start with the woman he christened Josephine. "He doesn't love me," she told a friend. "He worships me." The feelings of his bride were not quite so intense at first. Napoleon departed for military campaigns in Italy 2 days after their marriage, and Josephine immediately took a lover. But the two outsiders, she from the French-owned islands of the Caribbean, he from Corsica, recognised themselves mirrored at each other's core. Their relationship, in all its stormy, mutually unfaithful, ultimately doomed glory, would become one of the most famous romances in history. Even though on their respective deathbeds, each spoke the other's name as their last words, the marriage wouldn't last. As always, events out of Josephine's control ensured that. 5 years after the coronation, on November the 30th, 1809, Napoleon and Josephine again dined together in the Tuileries Palace, and again they sat in silence. On that occasion, she felt anything but immortal. The meal lasted barely 10 minutes. 10 excruciating minutes for Josephine as she awaited the inevitable. Once the servants had cleared the dishes, Napoleon placed his elbows on the table, steepled his fingers, pursed his lips, and informed his wife that for reasons of state, reasons that she must accept with bravery, their marriage must come to an end. From the next room, the prefect of the palace, Count Bosset, heard a horrific wailing. The doors to the dining room flew open, and there was Napoleon, agitated, ordering Bosset in to help him carry a prostrate, senseless Josephine to her apartments. For all the strength of their bond, the emperor needed an heir, and Josephine, now 46, would not provide him with one. She had a son and daughter from her previous marriage, and Napoleon had fathered a child with one of his lovers, but the imperial marriage remained without issue. The marriage was annulled within weeks, and in the spring of 1810, barely 4 months after that traumatic Tuileries dinner, Napoleon married the politically expedient Marie-Louise, Princess of Austria, who bore him a son the following year, as he lamented, "I have married a womb." A measure of the affection and respect the emperor retained for his former wife persists in that he never removed from her the title of empress. She installed herself and her children at the Château de Malmaison, west of Paris, turning what had been a run-down, ramshackle property into a glorious palace with exquisite gardens, hothouses, and a menagerie of animals from all around the world. There were emus, flying squirrels, and an orangutan who ate at the table with diners. Society still flocked to her. When she died on May the 29th, 1814, aged 51, it was the result of a chill she'd caught while walking in the Malmaison grounds with Tsar Alexander I of Russia. Napoleon, by then exiled on the island of Elba, learned of Josephine's death via a long out-of-date French newspaper. He shut himself away in his bedchamber for days. Beneath it all, the exotic flora and fauna, the coronation, the imprisonment, the widowhood, the brush with the guillotine, another brush with death in 1800, when a bomb intended for Napoleon exploded next to her carriage, the sexual bacchanalia, the golden years of her empress status, during which she spent more on clothes and had more ladies-in-waiting than Marie Antoinette, beneath all the reinventions, pragmatism, and scheming, Josephine was still at heart Marie-Joseph Rose Taché de la Pagerie, the Creole daughter of a sugar plantation owner born on the island of Martinique. The combined effects of a hurricane and her father's gambling debts had in the late 1770s led her aunt to facilitate marriage to a French viscount to save the family's fortunes. Hence, in the late summer of 1779, the 16-year-old, going by her childhood family nickname of Yayette, left the only life she had ever known and sailed for France with her father to marry a man she'd never met. Shortly after they disembarked at Brest on the coast of Brittany, Alexandre de Beauharnais arrived from Paris and expressed clear and immediate disappointment in his plump, plain fiancée and her weird accent. This marriage of financial convenience, which would secure Alexandre's fortune as well as protecting the future of Josephine's family, produced two children, but was inevitably unhappy, the Viscount ultimately sending his wife and children to a convent. It was there, where she spent a year living with and learning from other spurned society wives, that Yayette was abandoned for the persona that would become Josephine, Empress of the French. She left the convent glamorous, stylish, and desirable, the ultimate society dame, seducing the rich and powerful, first to survive and then to progress. Alexandra's beheading and her own close shave with the guillotine, her trial, a foregone conclusion, was slated for the day after the government fell, was just one watershed of many for Josephine in an extraordinary life, overshadowed by that of her second husband. Indeed, she lives on almost entirely in the apocryphal phrase, "Not tonight, Josephine," a fate similar to that of many great women of history, who are dismissed as wives, mothers, and concubines. In fact, the tangible legacy today of the woman discarded for not producing an imperial heir is as the direct ancestor of the current royal houses of Belgium, Greece, Luxembourg, Norway, and Sweden. It could be that Josephine's final peaceful years at Malmaison were her happiest. Maybe the tropical flora she installed and nurtured in her hothouses transported her back to her early years, the only time she was truly free, running and laughing under the Caribbean sun, sucking on sugarcane, revelling in being plain old Yayette, the planter's daughter. Great European Lives is brought to you by The New European. It's written and presented by Charlie Connolly, and the series producer is Steve Anglesey.